everybody. Welcome back. I'm Anu Rangarajan. I'm from the Indian Institute of Sciences, Bangalore. And I would like to thank Vidya for inviting me for this very wonderful conference. And for the first time in my life, I'm exposed to more discussion and less data. I go usually to talks where every slide is flooded with talks. And the physicist, friend and colleague in the audience has already cautioned me that he goes to sleep whenever he sees that. So I promised him, I don't know where he is, that I will not show any of the black and white bands, the RT-PCR and the gel pictures, that's what he means by that. And I will try to convince you by not showing data, but by showing that believe in what I'm saying. Okay, with that apart, I also have a request. For the time being, for the next 50 minutes or so, by which I would be giving my talk, just forget what you heard from Carlos. If you can do that, it would be very difficult for me. All right. I'm going to try to talk to you on three things today, that is time permits. A cancer stem cell model, EMT, or epithelial to mesenchymal transition and its implications in drug resistance, and EMT, I'm going to propose if this is, and get a feeling from the audience if you'd like to accept what I propose, EMT as a stress response. So to get going, I'll reintroduce the terminologies because I asked you to forget what Carlos said. So if I ask any of you to give me a piece of your flesh, you would pretty much give me the skin, which is the easiest one for me to take from you also. If I would take that, put them in tissue culture and start growing them. That is impossible. All right. If I were to grow cells in culture, which I get from you, I would call these as primary cell culture, or these are also cells which we can call normal, that is if we consider ourselves normal human beings. I will put them in culture, they will grow, and after a finite period of divisions, they stop dividing. This is what Hayflick termed as, this is what we termed as Hayflick limit, and it's also known as senescence. So by senescence, what we mean is the cells no longer have in them the ability to divide. They are metabolically active, but they are mitotically inactive. You will very quickly appreciate then that if a normal cell enters into this business of senescence, it no longer can be converted into a cancerous cell, because the very fundamental property of cancerous cell, which is proliferation, is lost on this cell. So one of the earliest steps, perhaps, in the process of carcinogenesis is the ability to bypass the senescence, if it happens, and to acquire what is called as immortality, or the ability to divide and proliferate many times. Such cells are termed as immortalized cells. So the immortalized cells differ from their primary counterparts only in not undergoing senescence, but that apart, they are not actually transformed or cancerous cells. In order for these cells to become actually transformed, they need to acquire additional genetic alterations, by which they also acquire several additional properties. These properties are, they no longer obey the laws of the neighbor, there is no contact inhibition that they obey, they do not require growth factors for their division and proliferation, they can grow in three dimensions. They can grow in three dimensions, whereas these cells can only grow in two dimensions, and this two dimension being the tissue culture plate in which we grow cells experimentally, or in our body the cells grow attached pretty much to the basement membrane. So pretty much it looks like there are multiple changes that need to take place in a primary normal cell for it to actually traverse and become a transformed cell. One of the theories that has been proposed and often considered to be having proven or also at least seen in biology is that cancers arise due to accumulation of multiple mutations, and it arises typically as a clonal outgrowth. What do we mean by this? A cell amidst a tissue of normal cells acquires mutations. The cell, if the mutation allows it to grow, it gives its proliferative advantage or survival advantage, this cell will grow. By virtue of its gaining the ability to grow and divide, there's a likelihood that it will acquire additional mutations. Such additional mutations typically allow this single cell which acquires multiple such mutations to grow out as clonal population. Just keep this mind at the back of it. Keep this at the back of your mind, and we'll come back to this, why this could be correct or incorrect. So how do experimental biologists test for carcinogenesis in their laboratory? On the left-hand side is an in vitro experiment, and on the right-hand side is an in vivo experiment. If I were to be given a bunch of cells called cancerous, one of the first things I would do in my laboratory is to take these cells, make single cells out of these, and subject them in agar. We are typically used to growing bacteria on agar. So we use the same agar, but instead of liquid LB, we put the DMA media. What we do is we make a slurry of the cells along with the agar, pour this agar on dishes, and now allow the agar to settle. While the agar settles, the cells get embedded in multiple areas. They are fixed in that area. What agar prevents it from doing is going down and attaching to the bottom of the plate. Attachment to the bottom of the plate, or attachment in general, is a requirement from a normal cell. If the cell is deprived of attachment, it will die. Whereas a cancerous cell will not die. Not only will it not die, it will give rise to clonal colonies of this nature, and these are called soft agar colonies. The agar we use is a little softer than the bacterial agar, and therefore it gets the name soft agar. This allows the cells to grow in a three-dimensional way in an anchorage-independent manner. Anchorage independence is a very fundamental property of most solid tumors or epithelial cancers. However, this experiment does not test for the ability to invoke angiogenesis, which is, of course, a prime requirement for cancer progression. The model on the right-hand side, this experimental model, allows one to test that also. If we take cancerous cells, inject them into immune-compromised mice. Of course, the mice has to be immune-compromised, otherwise it will throw a host versus a graft rejection. To avoid that, we use immune-compromised mice, and these immune-compromised mice act as surrogate animals, surrogate recipients for the cancerous cells that I may take from either animals or from humans. By introducing these cells into the animal, I wait for a period of a month or so. At the end of it, I will get a lump of cancer over here. This tells me now that the ability of the cancer, that it has the ability to grow new angiogenesis or to grow new blood vessels into it, because we have a fixed number of cells that can be supplied with nutrient and whatever is required, and that is described as the limit of diffusion from the nearest neighboring vessel to the cells. It's around 100 to 150 micron meter. As cancer grows, these cells obviously do not have a nearest neighboring vessel. What they do is they secrete factors that allows the growth of blood vessels from a neighboring vessel into the growing cancer, which then enables the cells of the cancer to grow and divide and become more. What I want you to concentrate now on is the numbers on the side of these two arrows. What this tells us is that if I seed somewhere around 10,000 cells in this experiment, at the end of a week or 2 to 3 weeks, I would get roughly 10 to 100 colonies coming out of it. What happens to the rest of the cells? What it basically means is that typically only few cells of a cancer actually have the ability to give rise to these colonies. One could call these, it's an in vitro experiment, it could be an in vitro artifact. One could even give many other reasons why this could be happening. For instance, I take tumor tissues from a patient. The tumor tissue is known, it's accustomed to grow in a patient. I take it out and I put it in vitro. It could be simply because the cells are not adapted to grow in vitro. But if I were to take even HeLa, the cancer cell line that almost grows in every cancer biologist laboratory, you would notice that not every cell that comes out of a HeLa cell culture would actually give rise to colonies. The same thing actually recapitulates itself in an in vivo experiment. I need to typically inject around 1 million cells into an animal to get a tumor of 1 cubic centimeter at the end of 4 to 6 weeks. Now, if you would do a rough mathematics, you would realize that if every cell divided with an average division time of 24 hours, within a month, you would get a tumor that is probably several times the size of the animal itself. So clearly, in both the in vitro experiment and in the in vivo experiment, all the cells are not contributing to the so-called carcinogenic property, and what is it? Anchorage-independent growth and the ability to give rise to cancer. Why is this? This data, this fact, has actually been staring at us since the day one these experiments have been performed, and you can say it's 50 to 60 years since we have accepted that this is how cancer cells behave in culture. What we fail to ask is there probably a science behind it? Of course, some people did ask, some theories were proposed, and I'm going to discuss two such theories to you. Both these theories are going to address why is it that every single cancer cell is unable to give rise to a colony in vitro or is unable to contribute to in vivo tumor formation. The stochastic model here proposes that to begin with, every cell in the tumor mass is homogeneous. That is, any individual cell actually has the ability to give rise to a tumor. However, at any given point of time, only a few actually end up doing so, and these few are determined by chance or it is stochastic. Now, we are very familiar with such stochastic events happening in vivo during development. A simple example is the Drosophila sensory neuron development. The bristles develop from an ectodermal sheet of cells. To begin with, all the ectodermal cells which have the ability to give rise to the ectoderm, they are uniform. There is a heterogeneity decided, perhaps by not signaling, which determines where the sense organs or the neuronal differentiation is going to set in. Once that happens, there is a uniform distance or a placement at which these sensory organs develop. But to begin with, which cell is going to give rise to the sense organ is again left to chance or stochasticity. Therefore, this model predicts that any cell has the ability, but the one that actually does so is determined only by chance. The opposing model actually predicts that to begin with, tumor or cancer is a heterogeneous mass, that there are cells that are green or orange. I've put these colors only to make it easy for us to understand and talk about it. that to begin with cancer is heterogeneous, and there are only a few cells, perhaps the orange cells, which have in them the ability to give rise to colonies or have in them the ability to give rise to cancers. The rest, or in this, as you can see, the bulk of the cells do not have in them the property. So the two models basically differ in how many cells within a cancer actually can give rise to the ability to being able to participate in a cancer. If the latter model were true, one could see that you should be able to segregate the green and the orange cells, and the model predicts that the green cells when injected into an animal will not be able to give rise to a tumor, whereas the orange cells when injected into an animal should be able to give rise to a tumor. If I don't put this green and orange, everything looks the same. That has been one of the major problems to scientists, how to segregate these green and orange cells from a tumor mass when you work with it. The first evidence that such a heterogeneity actually exists, and such a functional heterogeneity actually exists, actually came in the context of leukemia, acute myeloid leukemia cells, in which it was shown that a subpopulation of cells, or the orange cells, which had the phenotype of CD34- and CD38+. Now, if those of you who get bogged down by these CD, I would just say that the CD stands for cluster of differentiation. The meaning has no relevance to what I'm using it for. It's simply a cell surface protein. And if it's expressed in a cell, it gives me the ability to isolate it using a flow sorter, because I can throw an antibody that it will recognize this particular protein. I can then subject it to a flow sorting machine, and I will be able to pull the cells out. So it actually typically acts as a phenotypic marker. It has no relevance at this point of time for the function of the cell. So leukemic cells that had the phenotype of CD34- and CD38+, turned out to be a subpopulation of cells that alone had the ability to give rise to a new tumor, whereas the rest of the cells in the population failed to. So this was the beginning to understand that actually cancers are functionally heterogeneous, that some cells may have the ability to give rise to cancer while the others don't. So this was in the year 1994. So the question then was, is this paradigm going to hold true for only the leukemic or the blood cells? Would it hold true for adult cancers, which is pretty much to a large extent solid tumors? So the answer came, yes, it came in almost a decade after the leukemia study. It came in 2003 that indeed in the context of breast cancer, CD44 high and CD24 low cells actually are the only cells that have in them the ability to give rise to a tumor, whereas the rest of the cells or the bulk do not have in them the ability. Thereafter, this was followed suit with half a dozen other tumors in which such subpopulation of cells using a variety of other cell surface markers have been identified. Does this mean that every tumor that we have encountered so far has such a subpopulation? This is yet to be known. Does this mean that every single breast cancer has such a subpopulation? Perhaps not. What this entire theory tells us is that let's start looking at carcinogenesis in a somewhat different way. Perhaps if this offers us a different way of looking at cancer, perhaps can we now start looking at how to treat cancers also differently? At the end of my talk or somewhere in the middle, I will tell you why this model that only a subpopulation of cells can give rise to cancer, the clinical relevance that is associated with it, I will discuss. So the gist of these experiments is, if you segregate cancer into green and orange cells, the bulk or the green cannot give rise to tumors, whereas the orange cells have the ability to give rise to tumors. Some more properties. I told you previously that I needed to inject 1 million cells into an immune-compromised mice to get a tumor. However, if I were to now take hundreds, only hundreds, or even some people have done experiments with tens of cells, a small number of cancer stem cells can now give rise to cancer. So telling that in the 1 million cells, the number of such cancer stem cells were probably very minimal, and therefore it required those many of the bulk cells to be injected. Whereas if I take only a subpopulation of the pure cells, perhaps we don't need it. Two more properties that make it very interesting are, one can isolate the orange cells from a parent tumor, it goes into an animal, take the cells out, you could once again sort the cells, you could once again make a green and orange cocktail for you, keep going into animals. These orange cells have in them the ability to propagate tumor at least 4 to 6 generations, and this has been now shown for multiple tumors. In addition, I want you to appreciate the fact that even though scientists are putting in only orange cells, the output that comes contains both now orange and green cells. So what it says is that the orange cells have in them to recapitulate the parent heterogeneity or give rise to cells of a different nature than what they themselves are. These two properties, extensive proliferation and differentiation, in today's terminology would be associated very closely with stem cells. Come to that right in the next slide. So in a nutshell, what are cancer stem cells? These are few within several cancers. They can be identified to a large extent by cell surface markers. As few as 100 or tens of these cells can give rise to cancer. They show long-term replication potential, quote-unquote self-renewal, and they also can give rise to cell types, other cell types that are present in the tumor, again, quote-unquote differentiation. Now, sure.
How can you tell whether the new green cells that are coming out are not the cells of the host animal which have been corrupted?
Could you repeat the question? How do scientists know that when the orange cells go in and they come back, that the rest of the green cells here are not actually of the coming off the orange cell, but they are coming from the host, which in this case happens to be the mice? Typically, these are human cells transplanted into mice, and the markers for the humans are different from that of the mice, A. And B, people have typically put GFP or RFP into the human cells so that it makes it very easy right in the beginning to know whether it is human or mouse. So it is known that these are indeed human cells. There was another question? So this pattern is very similar to what we in today's life functionally define stem cells. So stem cells are cells that on the one hand can self-renew, make more of their own kind. On the other hand, these cells can differentiate and give rise to the variety of other cell types present in that one particular tissue. So if you look at it now, the most important question then that arises in my mind is, what is the cell of origin of cancer? We have a multitude of cells in the normal tissue. We have the stem cells, we have the progenitors, we have the differentiated cells. One property that I didn't mention is, as the stem cell divides and gives rise to progenitor cells first, these progenitor cells are cells that have fast proliferating potential, but not a very extended proliferation potential. So a stem cell has a very vast, extensive proliferation potential and not the progenitors. The progenitors quickly divide 4 to 5 times, but they are more prone, they are more tuned to differentiate and give rise to the differentiated cell of the tissue. So now, which of these cells does cancer arise? This is an extremely controversial field at this point of time in cancer biology. Forget how cancers arise, but what is the cell type? Earlier, we didn't bother so much about it because we didn't know the existence of these many variety of cells. Now we know that almost in every tissue that we have, there is a stem cell, there are progenitors, and there are these differentiated cells. Let's take one by one, case by case, and argue for and against points which could be the cell of origin. Differentiated cells, in most epithelial tissues, the differentiated cells do not divide. The term differentiation indicates that prior to them, the requirement is they quit proliferation and then they differentiate. A non-dividing cell, it's very difficult to imagine it to propagate the mutation. So by that you can eliminate that differentiation cells are the cells in which cancers originate. Progenitor cells, I mentioned that they divide 4 to 5 times and thereafter they differentiate. So the 4 to 5 divisions perhaps is not sufficient then to accumulate what is now known as the requirement of a normal cell to become cancerous perhaps requires 4 to 8 individual mutations to accumulate within a cell. If that were the case, then progenitors do not have in them the proliferative potential to acquire actually those many mutations, and probably in the meantime they would be slowed off or they would be kicked out of the system. So if you look at stem cells now, they offer a very good starting cell type in which cancers can arise for the simple reason that they already have in them inherently several properties that are required to become carcinogenic. For instance, we already looked at the hierarchical organization. Just like the normal tissue, it appears that the cancer tissue also has a hierarchical organization such that there are cancer stem cells giving rise to cancer stem cells, and the cancer stem cells on the other hand giving rise to these bulk cancer cells which probably are no longer carcinogenic. We often hear about telomerase. Telomerase is reacquired during carcinogenesis. It turns out that our normal stem cells also have telomerase because they are the cells that stay with us in our body since we are born till the end of our life. And they do have telomerase activity which helps them for extensive self-renewal. Sometime later, I would also tell you that we often associated cancer cells with the anchorage independent property, but it's now come to be commonly believed that normal stem cells also can actually divide and proliferate in anchorage independent condition. And in fact, I would be using one such system to actually enrich for such cells. So it turns out now, and also stem cells stay in our body for the longest time. So given all these criteria, many scientists have actually now started thinking, is it possible that the cell of origin of cancer indeed is the normal stem cell? So this we need to keep in mind in an era where we talk about stem cell therapy as a cure for almost every disease. So where is it, what is it that we are doing in my laboratory around it? So we decided, let's ask the question. All these are thoughts, all these are concepts. Which cell is the origin? Nobody really knows, but there are tons of review articles that have been written both in support or against it. We decided to ask the question. Is it possible that breast cancer which is a disease now people believe of 2,000 different types, actually arises in normal stem or progenitor cells. The reason we ask this question is, if we were to start addressing cancer, how it originated or what is the cell type in which it originated, taking the cancer tissue as the starting material, it's extremely difficult for us to figure out what happened, because this is the final output of cancer. Whatever changes have occurred have actually already occurred. However, how do we ever get to know what changes occurred in it? Can we take an approach wherein we take normal cells, and which normal cells now? Not the normal differentiated cells, but normal stem or progenitor cells, and try to ask, if I now somehow manage to convert it, A, can I convert a stem progenitor cell into a cancerous cell? And B, if I do manage to do so, how is it going to correspond with the clinical, the samples that we get from the clinic or the breast cancer patient samples? How is it going to correlate with that? So this is the question that we addressed. And so the starting material we needed, therefore, in my laboratory was an enrichment of breast, stem, or progenitor cells. There are multiple ways in which one can do it, and the simplest and improvement approach is what I told you just 2 minutes ago, that, okay, I'll go back and say, most of the time we do tissue culture, we take cells and we grow them in tissue culture plate. So much the business has grown that there are, you see, multitudes of companies that sell tissue culture plastics, and they say, my plastic is better than other person's because your cells will stick better. It turns out that the moment cells stick, they also differentiate. So by differentiating, I'm losing the very population of cell that I'm interested in. So. Now it turns out that if I seed cells, normal cells, in a tissue culture environment, majority of the cells die if I put them in an anchorage-independent condition. This is what led to the notion that normal cells die when subjected to tissue culture environment or an anchorage-independent condition. But if you were a postdoc who would want to take a vacation, leave this plate like this, when they were single cells, and assuming that they are going to die by the time I come back, and come back, and lo and behold, you might find that some of them have actually started proliferating and started giving these kind of spheres. Perhaps this is what happened with the person who actually got this. This was done to Italian 2003. They showed 99% of the cells do die, but less than 1% of the cells survive, the normal mammary cells, and give rise to these kind of three-dimensional structures, which they refer to as mammospheres. Such sphere structures of other normal tissues have also been shown. Salivary cells are known to form salivospheres, neurospheres, and you name it, and there are several tissues in which normal stem progenitor cells have been shown to divide and give rise to structures of this nature. We in my laboratory took the same and went one step ahead and asked, is it indeed true that when cells grow in adherent condition, they differentiate, whereas when cells grow in anchorage-independent condition, they have more stem-like properties? We simply took a, I'm sorry for my physicist friend, there's one RT-PCR data here. This is an RT-PCR experiment to compare attached cells versus mammary cells. The cells originated from the same patient biopsy. We took it and put it in either adherent culture or in non-adherent culture. And we took the cells and made RNA out of it and looked for markers of stemness, and if you can appreciate it, compared to the adherent culture, the mammospheres, all the markers that are involved with stemness are actually increased, suggesting that it is indeed true that adherent culture or anchorage-dependent culture promotes differentiation, whereas anchorage-independent culture promotes stemness. So how do we get to these cells? We started experiments with getting tissue biopsies from the hospital. We have a good collaboration with the oncology clinic. They give tissues which we bring to the lab after mechanical digestion and enzymatic digestion. We get single cells which, when subjected in anchorage-independent conditions, give rise to cells, mammospheres of this nature. I must point out to you that there were people who were making money by saying, take, buy my plate, and they now give you the best attachment. The same companies now have gone back and say, take my plate. They allow least attachment, and so we are actually stuck, because there also we were paying a lot of money in buying plates. Now also we are buying plates. It's just that the motto changed. Okay, how do I know that these spheres actually contain stem cells? Two fundamental properties: a stem cell should be able to self-renew and also differentiate. So when I take single cells out of these mammospheres, put them in culture, and once again allow to form spheres, if they do that, I know that they have stem cell-like cells. On the other hand, if I put them in differentiating conditions, they do form a duct-like structure in these, and I put them in Metrogel and allow them to differentiate, suggesting that indeed these contain stem-like cells. Are all of them stem cells? No. Today, if somebody tells you I have a pure population of stem cells, please don't believe it. Nobody has a pure population of stem cells. Okay. So we started looking at the properties of these, how long can we propagate them in culture, because nothing is known about it. All that we know about are cells that grow in tissue culture petri plates, but these are cells that grow on the tissue culture petri plates. So we were surprised that we could keep them in culture. So when we would make mammospheres, trypsinize, each week we trypsinize, put them as single cells, we asked, will they make another sphere, keep doing the same, and we uncovered that we can only take them for four passages. So these are all passages in suspension culture now. Why is it that these cells fail to propagate beyond the fourth passage, which roughly corresponds to 1 month? We asked several questions. Do the cells all differentiate? Do they lack the stem cells in there? Do they undergo what? The final, to cut a long story short, the answer turns out to be that even in this kind of a tissue in vitro culture, the cells undergo senescence. And as I said earlier, when cells undergo senescence, they stop dividing. Obviously, dividing cells can no longer generate another set of mammospheres. I would do tell you that around 60 to 70% of the cells in my milieu are undergoing senescence. What I don't know right now, has my stem cell undergone senescence? Or is it the senescent milieu or the senescent microenvironment which is preventing the resident stem cell from giving rise to mammospheres? But all I do know is, beyond the fourth passage here, I cannot get my in vitro, the mammary stem progenitor cells to grow. Now, this is the problem. I set forth making cancer, trying to make cancer from these cells. If they don't divide, I'm in trouble. So how do I overcome this problem of senescence, which those who did 2D culture encountered, and I'm also encountering? So how do I take my primary mammospheres, prevent them from undergoing immortalization, and allow them to undergo transformation? So the strategy that I used was very well pioneered in Bob Weinberg's lab, and I happened to do my postdoc right around the same time. What they had shown was, if you took cells in culture that are primary cells, now these are the cells which are growing in 2D. So if you take cells, primary cells, from normal primary cells, you can introduce defined genetic elements 1, 2, and 3, and convert a normal cell into an immortalized and a transformed cell. They did this not for one cell type, but for several cell types, thus saying that we can actually take cells which are normal, we can take them in culture, we can engineer them to express a few oncogenes or suppress a few tumor suppressor genes, and thereby convert them into a transformed cell. Right? I used this as a strategy, but the starting cell point that I used was not one that were growing in two-dimensional culture, but the starting cell point I used was the cells that were growing in three-dimension, and by virtue of that, I have an enriched population of stem progenitor cells. I did exactly the same time, but I needed to make lentiviruses because stem progenitor cells are slow dividing. They would not take up foreign DNA. So I made lentiviruses that express simian virus 40. I just go back and spend a second. So the three genetic elements that they introduced was the catalytic domain of human telomerase that is required for solving the end replication problem, the simian virus 40 early region, which encodes for proteins. Ultimately, what I want you to remember is the simian virus 40 antigens inhibit three tumor suppressor genes within the host cell. And the third one was an oncogenic RAS, which triggers and multiple cellular signal transduction pathways. So the combination of 1, 2, and 3 sufficed to convert a normal cell into a cancerous cell. So we did the same strategy, as I said, but with the difference, we very minimally allowed the cells to attach, always kept them in suspension. And the result is, these are controlled experiments done, which tells you that in starting with the same cell population, we split them into five cultures. Either one of them got no vector, got an empty vector, one oncogene, second gene, or a combination. By doing this, we realized that just like the previous experiments, the y-axis here shows the number of passages the cells can be propagated in suspension, with 1 week being the suspension time. Shows clearly that single oncogenes did not allow them to proliferate beyond 8 passages, but when I have a combination of simian virus 40 large T and human telomerase, these cells now could be propagated in suspension for a prolonged period of time, thereby telling me that they are now immortal. Are they only immortal? Now, before that, we'll just compare with what was done previously in Bob Weinberg's lab. They had used cells that were adherent. So this is how I'm depicting an adherent cell. They introduced the same oncogenes. These adherent cells could not give rise to spheres. Sphere formation thereby now functions as a stemless property right now. In this case, in contrast, when I start off with cells that are spherical, that are enriched in stem progenitor cells, by introducing the same genetic element, I'll get cells now that can form spheres. If I undertake analysis by using RT-PCR and Western blot, I also notice that these cells do not have stemness or EMT markers, whereas these cells have stemness or EMT markers. By merely starting from with a different starting population of cell, I have enriched for cells that do many more things than what had happened in their experiments almost a decade ago. I was curious, what's the nature of cells in the population that I've created? So the cells we have engineered, we call them NBLE. N stands for normal breast, L stands for the large T antigen, and E stands for telomerase. So normal breast tissue harboring large T antigen and telomerase. It turned out that the two major cell types in the breast tissue are the myoepithelial and the luminal cells. If I differentiate and ask, what is the nature of the cell population that these generate? It turned out that only 5% of them gave rise to pure luminal colonies. Only 5% gave rise to pure myoepithelial. Majority of them gave rise to a mixed colony, thereby suggesting that much of the cells in NBFE, are bipotent progenitors that have in them the ability to either give rise to myoepithelial or give rise to luminal epithelial. So that's the starting point we seem to have. So the most interesting experiment then was to inject them in nude mice and then ask, do they form tumors? And the answer was yes. The cells that contain simply the two oncogenes, large T and telomerase, generate tumors. How do we know these are the tumors formed of our cells? As I mentioned, we have green GFP that I engineer into them as I put in the introduce the oncogenes. We also know that they express these oncogenes because large T antigen, I can track it by doing an immunohistochemistry using an antibody against large T.
Sorry, could you go back to the previous slide?
Yes.
So what is the bipotent part?
So the ability of any cell to give rise to two types of cells. This is a terminology often used in stem cell terminology, in stem cell field. If a cell has in it the ability to form only one type of cell, for instance, in this case, if a cell formed only a myoepithelial cell or the luminal cell, it would be called a unipotent. It has a potency to give rise to either one type of cell or multiple. So if it, for instance, if it can give rise to multiple cell types, then it would be called a multipotent. If it can give rise to two, it's bipotent. If it can give rise to only one, it's unipotent. So far so good. We have engineered a couple of oncogenes into normal stem progenitor cells, converted them into cancers. Now we wanted to know what's the nature of the cancer that the cells that we have engineered in our laboratory actually makes. Before that, I need to point out that previously such systems were developed. Lots of in vitro transformation models have been developed. But it turns out that none of them actually mimic. They all make cancers, which represent 2, 5, or less than 5% of all cancers that arise in the breast cancer clinic. The major cancer that we encounter in the breast cancer clinic is an invasive adenocarcinoma. None of these previous models actually did it, trying to suggest that either the nature of the oncogene they have used or the starting cell type that they have used is probably not is not the right combination of whatever they have done. One study did get malignant adenocarcinoma, but in that case, they had to use a RAS oncogene. You may have heard that RAS is an oncogene present in 50% of all cancers. When it comes to breast cancer, only less than 5% of breast cancers actually have RAS mutations. So the oncogene that they used to make this model is not a relevant oncogene for the breast cancers. Whereas the cells that we generated gave rise to invasive ductal adenocarcinoma, which is what 85%, which is the largest type of cancer, which is what you encounter in the clinic as well. On top of it, these cancers, these cells, gave rise to what is called as a triple negative. They are negative for hormone receptors, ER, PR, and HER2-neu, and such triple negative cancers are the highly, highly aggressive cancers that are encountered in the clinic. Trying to go back and suggest perhaps that when you start off with a stem cell, you may get aggressive cancer. We'll come back to speculations a little later. So this is with respect to, yes, you can form tumors. Yes, they give rise to a histochemistry, which is very comparable with what happens in the clinic. But what happens? Do they really contain the cancer stem cell population? And the answer is yes. The starting population has the normal stem progenitor cells are contain around 12% of the CD44 high and CD24 low cells, which mark the stem cells for the breast, whereas the cancerous cells contain approximately 32%. And as one would expect for a typical cancer stem-like cell, it's only this subpopulation that gives rise to antigen-dependent colonies, whereas the other cell type fails to give rise to the antigen-dependent colony. So basically, I have created cells which, once again, the bulk of the cells fail to have tumorigenic property, whereas it's only the minority which seems to have, or a subpopulation which seems to have this property. This is in vitro. The same story holds true for in vivo. Once again, it's only the CD44 plus and 24 minus that can give rise to tumors. The rest, or the bulk, do not give rise to tumors. So we've created tumors, the tumors resemble what we encounter in the clinic, they also contain the cancer stem cell subpopulation. Molecularly, are they similar to what happens? So in order to address that, we undertook a microarray approach. We looked at gene expression of the cancer cells that we generated in our laboratory, compared it across with naturally arising cancers from patient biopsies. And it turned out that to a large extent, the cells that we generated, they do hold true, they do compare very well with what happens in the clinic, what the samples that you get in the clinic. They were previous to us, they were microarray profiles of tumor-initiating cells or breast cancer cells already existing in the literature. So we compared our data with that of what is existing in the literature, and it turns out that the cells that we have created, the cancer stem cells, appear to correlate very well with what was already available in the literature, suggesting thereby that by starting with normal stem progenitor cells, we have managed to convert them into immortalized cells, which can now be bifurcated as either the CD44 plus minus cells or the rest. These have the tumorigenic properties in them. These fail to have the tumorigenic properties. How does it compare with the model that was generated previously using the same strategy? When starting with adherent culture, these cells to begin with lacked stem cells. When they got immortalized, yes, they were immortalized, but they lacked stem cells. To begin with, if I use a stem progenitor population, to begin with, they have stemless, they continue to retain their stemless. While in this case, the cells by default required an oncogenic strong requirement of oncogenic RAS, we failed to require oncogenic RAS. Some of the conclusions that we can make, or some of the feelers that we can get from this study, is that this is perhaps one of the first studies to support a stem progenitor origin for epithelial cancers, for the simple reason that we started stem progenitor cells to begin with. It also suggests that if the cell of origin is a stem or a progenitor cell, it might require lesser number of oncogenic events, because the right-hand side model required only two elements that I needed to introduce, whereas the left-hand side that started off with a more differentiated starting cell required three, at least three. When we say two and three, it's more a count. There could be many more that are required. We also generated an extremely aggressive form of cancer, suggesting that the more aggressive cancers in the clinic are perhaps originate in stem progenitor cells. And at the end of the day, what we do have in our hands is a very unique model that allows us now to see what are the self-renewal mechanisms that may be going wrong in the system, or what are the properties that actually convert normal stem progenitor cells into a cancerous cell. Why is it now so important that we generate such a model and study cancer stem cells? I'll now go to the last slide of this part of my talk and tell you what's the clinical importance or the clinical implications of the entire cancer stem cell model. So you can imagine this to be a mass of cancer. We typically, conventional chemotherapy refers to what patients get today. When we give chemotherapy, the patient tumor size shrinks, but oftentimes you may hear that the patient comes back with a relapse. What is this relapse due to? The cancer stem cell model describes this relapse or gives an explanation for this relapse, suggesting that the conventional chemotherapy perhaps kills the bulk of the green cells. It leaves behind the cancer stem cell unharmed or untouched. The moment the cancer stem cell later acquires the properties that it can divide, it divides and gives rise to the whole of the cancer. So what the cancer relapse is doing is pretty much allowing the leftover cancer stem cells to divide and begin and become a new cancer. Can we now look at, and why is this? How do we have data to support it? That to begin with, one might want to ask, why is it that the conventional chemotherapy is leaving behind cancer stem cells unharmed? It turns out that these cancer stem cells express a large number of ABC transporters. These transporters, they take the drug and they efflux it out of the cell. So the more the drug you give, these cells are really not affected because they can pretty much efflux the cell. By virtue of expressing this high ABC transporters, the cancer stem cells are inherently chemoresistant. So is it now possible that we relook at cancer therapy by targeting cancer stem cells? We could look at it as a combinatorial therapy, wherein one could use the conventional therapy to get rid of the green cells, but also simultaneously target cancer stem cells. In such a scenario, when there is no target cancer stem cell left behind, probably the cancer will not arise. This is what the implications of the cancer stem cell model is. Where are we with respect to this? Is it available in the clinic right now? The answers are, there are many drugs that have come into the market. The literature says that there are some that target the cancer stem cells, and therefore they are very effective. It's not come in the field as in this is a targeted therapy against cancer stem cells yet, but this is where a lot of people are thinking, this is the line along which a lot of people are thinking, can we now generate drugs which will target the cancer stem cells and by that. So we don't only, there are two ways of looking at it. One could either target the orange cells such that the orange cells die. Yet another way of looking at it, can I convert the orange cell into a green cell? By doing that, the conventional chemotherapy can anyway kill it. So there are two ways by which you can eliminate the cancer stem cells. Now, I will digress. So if there are questions, should I...
That's an emergent phenomenon.
Okay. Maybe then I will... Okay, I actually wanted to talk about... I'll just quickly, I'll take maybe five...
Yeah, you can.
Okay, I'll take another 5-10 minutes. I'm digressing. That's the cancer stem cell model. We'll come back and we'll see at the end how we can correlate with everything that I'm talking to you now. We'll move on to cancer metastasis. This is a cartoon that a student of mine made, and what she wanted to depict was that cancer cells breach the basement membrane and then enter into lymphatics and blood vessels and thereby gain the ability to migrate and move into different parts. That is metastasized in a nutshell. More detail, a primary cancer occurs in the first site and there is a growth of cells, and these cells, when they breach the basement membrane, can enter the lymphatics or the blood vessel, go to a different new site, and in the new site, they can come out or extravasate and give rise to a tumor growth called a secondary tumor or a metastasis. Oftentimes, it's the secondary tumor or metastasis that is the cause of cancer-associated death. Primary tumors are very rarely the cause of death, unless they're putting a pressure on a vital organ. So there is an age-old correlation that doctors and clinicians have often observed in the clinic, and which is metastatic tumors tend to be very drug resistant. And if these cancers are drug resistant, they tend to be more aggressive and more metastatic. It's a circular argument. So if you have a cancer which is metastatic, if you treat it, then it suggests that probably it's going to only become more drug resistant. I want to give a small joke which my husband likes to say by way of introducing me. There's a person called Chitra Gupta who pretty much takes count of if a human being dies and goes to heaven. He takes count of, I'm keeping the track record of who has come and who has not come. So such one person arrives and Chitra Gupta is looking into his register and he's saying, well, your name is not supposed to come today. Why is it come today? You're supposed to come to me 6 months down the line. Wait a minute. Are you a cancer patient? Did you get chemotherapy by any chance? What this basically says is that by giving chemotherapy, probably the patient dies earlier. Don't take this out of this audience. Okay, fine. So we were very interested in understanding what could be the mechanistic implications of the relationship between metastasis and drug resistance. To begin with, we took cells which are either immortal, they are non-invasive, that is they are benign, or they are invasive, for instance. And we looked at the way they behave or the way they respond when we give chemotherapeutic drug, and in this case we have used doxorubicin. It turns out that not the immortal, not the invasive, but it's only not the non-invasive, it's only the invasive cells that respond to the presence of a chemotherapeutic drug by upping or increasing, showing an increase in their ABC transporter expression. You may recall ABC transporters are the ones that are present on the cell surface that take the drug and efflux it. By virtue of having an increased expression of ABC transporters, the non-invasive cells thereby are becoming more drug resistant because they somehow seem to respond to the presence of the drug by upping their ABC transporters. One phenomena that comes to, okay, before that. So what is the difference between a non-invasive cell and an invasive cell such that now an invasive cell is able to do this, whereas a non-invasive cell is not? Both are transformed, one is benign and one is malignant. So one big difference between an epithelial non-invasive cell and an invasive cell is that during transformation or during cancer progression, the cancer cells which are epithelial looking undergo a phenomena called epithelial to mesenchymal transition. What it literally means is that an epithelial looking cell actually transits and becomes a mesenchymal looking cell. How do they do it? Why do they do it? I will come to it a little bit, but I want to tell you that this phenomenon of epithelial to mesenchymal transition appears to be a phenomena that is required for the cancer cells to become, perhaps gain motility, become invasive and give rise to metastasis. Is this a phenomena that occurs only in cancer? No. In fact, this is a phenomena that occurs during early embryonic development, during gastrulation, during neural crest formation, during adult life, at the time of fibrosis, at the end of wound healing. And the cancer cells perhaps have only hijacked this mechanism that operates normally in a cancer cell. So what is an EMT? Epithelial cells are typically cemented to each other by virtue of several interactions that they have. Some of the characteristic hallmark features of this phenomenon of epithelial to mesenchymal transition is the loss of cell-cell and cell-ECM attachment. The cells also lose, the epithelial cells lose their apico-basal polarity. They attain a mesenchymal morphology, which is a more motile. If you just look at it, you can appreciate that by becoming linear and spindle, the cells perhaps can have a better motility than by being epithelial and sticking to each other. Perhaps that's why they do that, and they attain motility. And some of the way, how do we assess whether a cell is epithelial-like or mesenchymal-like? Epithelial cells have expression of these proteins. The loss of these proteins tell me that these cells are now losing their epithelial nature. And the gain of these mesenchymal markers listed over here tells me now that the cells are actually attaining a mesenchymal property. So I score for loss of epithelial markers and gain of mesenchymal markers if I have to score for EMT. So it turns out that, again, it's only the invasive cells that have expression of the markers of EMT. They show migration and they show invasion upon treatment with chemotherapeutic drug, but not the non-invasive or the immortal cell. So we went forth and asked, it looks then, EMT and drug resistance go hand in hand, that they are probably partners in crime. So is it then possible that this age-old correlation that the physicians have always seen is due to the fact that the EMT generating, the factors that trigger EMT are also the factors that give rise to drug resistance? And the molecule that we concentrated here were the ABC transporters. So what we asked was, what if we now take a non-invasive cell, introduce into it factors that induce EMT, will they now become invasive, A, and will they now become drug resistant, B? And the answer turned out, okay, how do we trigger EMT in cells? EMT can be triggered in multitudes of ways. Growth factors like TGF-beta, signaling pathways like Notch, receptor tyrosine kinases can trigger EMT. Hypoxia or physiological conditions like a hypoxia can trigger, and ultimately EMT is mediated by a net of transcription factors that operate in the nuclei. In our condition, we use three such mechanisms to trigger EMT, and the answer it turns out to be that if I convert a non-invasive cell into an invasive cell, they do increase their ABC transporter expression, they become EMT, and they also become more drug resistant, which can be appreciated by a shift in the IC50 values to the right hand side. How do I go about doing this in a reverse approach? What if I take invasive cells, inhibit EMT in it, or prevent these cells from undergoing EMT, will they revert back to a non-invasive phase and will they become drug sensitive? We did just that, and in order to do that, we used siRNA against Twist, which is known to be a master regulator of EMT. By putting in siRNA into an invasive cell, indeed we converted cells that were drug resistant and made them into drug sensitive cells, suggesting that EMT factors perhaps play a critical role in both inducing EMT as well as making the cells drug resistant. We further went on to show that the EMT factors go and bind to the promoter region of the ABC transporters. They thereby upregulate the transcription of the ABC transporters. So in a nutshell, what I've shown in this part is that EMT factors are novel inducers of drug resistance transporters. And if we take cells, which whether we induce EMT or we put drugs on them, they show an EMT phenotype. By virtue of that, they have an increase in the expression of EMT transcription factors, which then probably go and bind to the ABC transporter factor promoter and give rise to more increase in the expression of ABC transporters, which then leads to drug resistance. Perhaps the EMT factors are central to both invasion metastasis, on the other hand, drug resistance. So we put forth a cartoon in which we try to see how this will hold true in an in vivo real tumor. So tumor is heterogeneous. Tumors can have epithelial-like cells and mesenchymal-like cells. So at the first wave when they encounter a chemotherapeutic drug, perhaps it's the epithelial cells that are more more sensitive and thereby die, leaving behind these mesenchymal-looking cells, which then also increase their upregulation of EMT markers and everything. By virtue of increasing their EMT markers, they also increase their ABC transporters, by virtue of which they now become more drug resistant. I want you to now focus on what I spoke to you in the previous part, saying that when we treat cancers with drug, perhaps what is left behind are the cancer stem cells, which then give rise to cancer. Here, I'm saying something different. I'm saying, if I treat cancer, what we are left behind are these mesenchymal-looking cells, which then give rise to drug resistance. So what is this correlation between mesenchymal nature and stemness nature? It turns out that in the process, okay, missing something. In the process of converting an epithelial cell into a mesenchymal cell via EMT factors, I'm missing them over here. So if I put an EMT factor, the epithelial cell can become a mesenchymal-like cell. A data that came again from the Weinberg laboratory showed that such cells actually acquire stemness properties. What did we do in my laboratory? We put EMT markers and converted cells that became drug resistant. They increased their ABC transporters, pretty much trying to suggest that EMT, stemness, drug resistance, they are all linked phenomena. They are all regulated by similar molecules. When we get one, you also get the other. So by saying that cancer stem cells are more drug resistant, we also mean that they are undergone EMT. By saying that by generating EMT, I have got hold of cancer stem cells, we're also saying that by generating EMT, they've also given rise to increased drug resistance. All these phenomena perhaps go hand in hand. Now the very last slide, I want to impress upon you a thought that came based on the work that we did in our laboratory. This is a primary tumor, and as tumors grow, many of us know that it faces several kinds of stresses. As cells move away from the nearest blood vessel, they have less supply of oxygen, they have less supply of nutrients. As a result, tumors face a variety of stresses. Now, a molecule that has been involved or implicated in each of these stress phenomena and many others is AMPK. AMPK stands for AMP activated protein kinase. Many of the biologically relevant stresses to cancer that we encounter actually increases the activity of the AMPK protein. Can you imagine AMPK requires AMP as a substrate to become activated in an allosteric way? And in many of these conditions, as and when the energy levels are low, AMP levels increase, and that AMPK actually ends up activating AMPK. We recently in my laboratory found very concrete and solid evidence to suggest that if we activate AMPK in these cells, the cells can actually become EMT. That is, mere activation of AMPK is sufficient to convert a non-invasive cell into an invasive cell. On the corollary, if I inhibit AMPK in an invasive cell, such cells actually revert and no longer are EMT and they become epithelial in nature, suggesting that AMPK plays a critical role in the phenomena of EMT and thereby cell migration and metastasis. So what does this tell us about the way we interpreted this is, since AMPK is a protein that gets activated under stress conditions, is it possible that EMT, cell motility, gain in cell motility, migration, and metastasis per se is actually a stress response, a response that the primary cells realize that I no longer have food and nutrition in and around me. This stress activates AMPK, and in response to the stress, now the cells begin to start hunting for food in faraway area and thereby migrate, almost similar to human or migration in other organisms. Is it possible then, can we mimic or model cancer cell migration and metastasis as human or animal cell animal migration, organismal migration and movement? With that, I conclude my talk, and before that, I need to acknowledge people. So the two people who did much of the work that I shared with Mammospheres are Devavina and Anurag. People who worked with EMT and metastasis are Meera and Shravan. So this is the current heterogeneity in my laboratory. And the last word about the funding agencies that have really been very liberal in funding. Thank you for your attention. I take questions.
People are recovering their breath.
I think I just spoke too much.
I would like to go to your very first slide when you were showing this two kind of model. One is stochastic model and one is the hierarchical model.
Yeah.
In fact, 50 years ago, Lori and Delbrück were facing a very similar problem about resistance to virus. Is the resistance induced by the infection or if, and they could design a statistical test to separate them. And I was wondering if you could do the same kind of statistical test before going to the whole mechanism of molecular details to just distinguish between these two models.
Thought of it oftentimes, the Luria-Delbrück fluctuation, classical fluctuation test experiment, it's just a problem that cancer cells, when we grow them in tissue environment, they may acquire an additional mutation that you never know. This is, to begin with, a cancer cell. By virtue of being a cancer cell, it has already lost its tumor suppressors and its genome is unstable. I would never know, unless I do human genome sequencing for each of those cells, I would not have a way of knowing whether they have acquired an additional mutation.
But you showed also that they can form colonies, the surviving ones.
Yes, but the ability to form colonies is only one property of a cancer cell. I cannot use that
but
as a test.
Even if you just take that as a test, and you do that in, for example, 100 petri dish, and you count the number of colonies you have in each petri dish, would that follow a Poisson distribution or not? Just this property.
The only reason I don't do this experiment is because I'm not sure that every single cell there is still the same cell as my parent cell.
Can I interrupt?
Sure.
I think Bairam's point is purely statistical. Is whatever it is that the cell acquires something that happens after exposure to the new environment or the new condition, or is it something pre-existing? That probably can be tested statistically in the way that he suggests, without going into the question of how many mutational events were involved.
These are constantly evolving cells. So let's assume we end up doing this experiment, and let's do assume that we get the same result as Luria and Delbrück got at that point of time. But I will not be able to interpret for the simple reason that I do not know that single cell that actually either gave rise to a cancer or the colony or not, did it undergo an additional alteration than what I put in. With that in mind, I will not be able to extrapolate that and make any conclusions based on that.
Yeah, but suppose that you do this kind of, this very naive experiment and you find that the number of colonies is a Poissonian.
Okay.
Then wouldn't you be more inclined toward a stochastic model?
Yes, that's, absolutely, I would be.
So this is just as a rejection hypothesis, it would be nice to do the statistic.
It would be nice to do it. It's just that because it's a cancer cell, those were non-cancerous cells. So you were not worried about our additional mutations occurring. As I grow, the HeLa in your lab is a different HeLa than a HeLa in my lab. Right? That is how these cancerous cells' genome are unstable. So to say that, based on that, if I can make a conclusion, I can do an experiment of that nature, but I will not be able to make a conclusion.
I have naive question. You said you need a minimum number of cancer stem cells to initiate tumorigenesis, initiate a tumor. So what happens if you, why is it with a single cancer stem cell you don't get a cancer? Is it an immune response or is it reconverted to a normal cell?
You can call it, it's a technical impracticability, because you have to inject this one cell into an animal and assume that it actually went there. People have gone as low as 10. And I would say that if it is possible, people would have done it. It's just a practical impossible. There was a different assay, maybe yes.
If there is this connection, as you have very elegantly shown, between stemness and the propensity to form a tumor, could you take the various tissues in our body and look at the stemness of the tissue and make predictions as to whether they would originate tumors?
Many of our tissues have been put in culture and many of them do have stemness properties, some more and some a little less. But by simply knowing how much of stemness properties they have, I cannot really extrapolate to say whether they have a high propensity of becoming carcinogenic. They do vary, but then one cannot make a correlation of that nature. You're asking if the more the stemness, will there be a more propensity to become carcinogenic?
Or the other way around, if there are some tissues in which tumors never,
whether they have lesser numbers. I don't know.
Gopal. I just wanted to put up a point about distinguishing a normal cancer cell
versus a normal stem cell versus a cancer stem cell. And some of the work has some markers. 34 minus and 38 plus cells, but this is a marker which is there on normal cells also. And if one was to take, I think the source becomes important. This is where all these selection points come in, that if you take the same cells from a tumor background, they can get a phenotype. If you take from a normal background, you may not get a phenotype in an experiment. So, I mean, is there a subpopulation of normal stem cells which can be just theoretically referred to as cancer stem cells? Or would you think that there are separate group of stem cells which can only make cancer and do not perform any normal function?
Well, I don't see a reason for our body to keep aside a certain number of cells which would then wait to become cancerous. I would assume it's the same normal stem cell which does tissue replenishment, takes part in wound healing, injury recovery, etc. That it's the same cell which, when given a condition, which when faces the environment of a carcinogen, actually becomes tumorigenic. It's not
this
a cell...
This begs the key question, that what is that condition? I mean, it need not be a carcinogen at all. It is a normal cell which now chooses to behave called abnormally. It need not be any stimulus. That is what has been said. There is no mutation necessary sometimes.
I told you in the beginning, forget the previous talk. Okay. But then coming back to it.
That was over 15 minutes. No, now it's over.
Be it a normal stem cell, be it a normal cell, be it any cell that actually is going to become carcinogenic, I don't think it's left to the choice of the cell. The cell is doing what it is experiencing. There are multiple cells that seem to be facing the same carcinogen. Not every cell is turning out to becoming a cancerous cell.
Yeah.
It's stochastic, as with many other things that happen stochastic. You can either call it stochastic or it's in a correct environment. Right? Either one or the other. But I don't like this thing that the cell made a choice. I don't like to put a brain or a thought process into the cell. The cell had a choice and it did this. I believe the cell does whatever it faces and it encounters. If it encounters a mutagen, it undergoes a mutation, it does what the mutation dictates it to do.
As I understand it, when an invasive metastasized cell moves away from the primary cancer and moves to other sites, it still has some of the characteristics of the original primary site. And so it seems to have differentiated to some extent. Is that right? I mean, that once the change takes place to the primary site, there is some degree of differentiation which bears the characteristics of that site.
The metastatic tumor, does it bear any resemblance to the primary tumor from which it arose? The answer is two ways. If I were to ask a clinician, if I didn't tell the clinician where the site of the primary tumor is, I only gave the clinician the metastasized tissue, the clinician would never be able to trace it back to the organ where the primary tumor arose. That tells us that the tumor at the secondary site is so different from the primary tumor site. But molecular detailed analysis of expression patterns of genes have told that indeed the metastatic cancer has a lot of its bearing, a lot of its root in the primary cancer. Molecular analysis tells us that yes, it does resemble, but not at the physical appearance level.
So it has differentiated.
It does have differential different properties. Yeah. By virtue of it, you would say it has adapted to its new environment. Yeah. But it does have molecularly some of the properties that to begin with made it a cancerous.
Did you say that the pathologist does not recognize in the metastasis where the primary tumor was?
To a large extent, yes.
Sorry?
Yes. That's what my pathologist has said, and I've read that the metastatic tumor loses its characteristic to such an extent that it becomes difficult for the physician or the pathologist to trace it back to the origin, the original parent organ in which the tumor arose.
Well, that is not what the book said.
I have a question regarding...
I'm a little confused about AMPK levels. If you compare normal cells versus non-invasive ones, will there be any difference in the AMPK?
To begin with, if there is, yes, there is a difference. But when I do grow them in adherent culture, I will not get the difference. When I put them under conditions of stress, that is hypoxia, serum deprivation, nutrient deprivation, there is a distinct difference between my normal cell and the invasive cell with respect to the AMPK activity, but not in the 2D typical tissue culture environment. So I need to give the stress condition, then only I will figure out whether the two respond differently.
I have a question regarding your drug resistance model, so which is based mostly on the ABC transporter. But ABC transporter is not only the protein which is responsible for the drug resistance. So how could you explain that?
Okay. There are many mechanisms. ABC transporters is one such mechanism. I explored my entire model using ABC transporters, so that's the result. One could definitely look at other aspects of drug resistance in them.
Yeah, you only showed the one aspect. So have you tried inhibiting ABC transporter and making the...
Not only me, there are actually clinical trials that went up when people realized that ABC transporters do this job of effluxing the drug. Obviously, it came into the market. There's a drug called Verapamil that was tried and tested. The problem with that was it had multiple side effects. And one can imagine, ABC transporters did not go up on a cancer cell. It's present in all the normal cells for its normal job. It additionally happens to efflux the drug. So it is right now not possible.
But when your model is based on cell culture results, have you tried inhibiting the...
Verapamil extremely is a killer to the cell. You put it longer than 60 minutes, the cell has multiple, majority of the cells die. We do this experiment for sorting the SP, the site population cells. We use typically verapamil to block the ABC transporters. Cells don't like blocking ABC transporters. You must remember ABC transporters are there for doing some normal jobs. We don't understand. We have started looking at ABC transporters as markers of cancer.
Not good target.
It is not at all.
Albert, please pass on.
Yes, sir. So I have a question regarding AMPK and the possibility of a link with circadian rhythms. So there are two lines of evidence which show that in mice the rate of growth of a tumor increases when the circadian clock of the mice is inhibited or perturbed.
What is inhibited?
So if there are mutations in the circadian clock genes, for example...
The circadian clock.
The circadian clock. So the mutation grows faster. But then I also remember reading that there is a link between the circadian clock and AMPK.
Oh, I see. I didn't know that. That would be very interesting to explore.
Yeah.
I would
and then one could perhaps test what the status of AMPK in mice which disturb the circadian clock genes.
Sure. I would be delighted to look at it.
Could you go back to the slide in which you demonstrate that the first slides that the pioneers in which you have a tumor in an animal. It must be the previous one.
What's the point you want to bring?
Maybe the previous one?
No. You showed one in which the cells that were grown in culture, which you admit that it is the initiation of the somatic mutation theory, the new version of the somatic mutation theory.
What did the slide show?
There was a tumor, there was an animal with a tumor.
A real animal or a model?
A real animal, yes. I think that is it. Okay. So you admit to us, first of all, I wish to congratulate you because the audience did not take into consideration what I said. Second, here you admit that the origin of the oncogene theory has been done in culture, not in the animal. Right?
Okay.
Now, do you have data for the pioneers, have data to indicate that the tumor that you have on the right is a real tumor or is a just the behave as a metastasis? In other words, you selected for a single type of cell that eventually produced a tumor, but this has nothing to do with the process of carcinogenesis, right?
So this model, I wouldn't say that really...
Could you reframe the question and then answer?
Actually, that's the toughest part. I thought I'll answer and then see if I got it right. So does this, the fact that some cells were introduced into an animal and the cells gave rise to a cancer, does it support the somatic mutagenesis theory is what you're saying? The oncogene?
These cells were fibroblasts, right?
No, the cells I'm showing, these are all epithelial cells. But let's assume fibroblasts, doesn't matter, any cell.
Right.
Yeah. So what is the question once again?
The question is, this is not the way the tumor arises in a human being or in an experimental animal when you inject
okay.
the carcinogen.
Okay. So is this the way tumors arise? That is, we take these cells we have transplanted into an animal. His argument is this is not the way tumors arise in a human being. This experiment does not deal with tumor initiation.
So it's not an evidence favoring the idea of carcinogenesis. You cannot claim that an artifact like this is responsible for carcinogenesis.
I will rephrase. An experiment of this nature actually suggests that if I've given a group of cells, do these group of cells in them have the ability to give rise to a cancer? They would give rise to a cancer. That means previously, are they cancerous? That is what I'm asking. Are they cancerous is what I'm asking. Not how did they become cancerous?
This is what carcinogenesis is about.
Yeah, no, I think the question really is, by the way, I think this is something we should bring up after Prakash's talk in the afternoon, because one purpose of this meeting, certainly in my mind, is not so much to solve problems as to clarify issues.
Right.
And that we
yes.
should do, and I hope it comes up after Prakash's talk. So I think the question here has to do with genesis or origin,
yeah.
as opposed to spread.
Yes.
Yes, Prakash.
So what induces the differentiation of green cells from orange cells? Or is the purely stochastic?
In fact, let me go to the first one and say he's asking what induces the differentiation of the green cells into orange cells? The orange cells into green, you had the colors wrong.
Orange cells.
Okay. What induces the differentiation of the orange cells into the green cells? This is going back to, in our body, we have normal stem cells. The neighboring environment, the appropriate cue, together induces a stem cell to either divide and differentiate or divide and make more of its own kind. In a cancer as a tissue, it appears that similar mechanisms actually regulate whether the orange cell is now going to divide and make both orange cells, or whether it's going to divide and make both green cells, or is it going to divide and make one green and one orange. So it seems to be governed pretty much by similar laws that govern the normal stem cell within our body to either divide or differentiate. And to a large extent, we don't know those cues.
My question is, why do not they differentiate in one particular type, for example, any cell type? Why they are stuck at one particular space? Why do not they divide, for example, a skin cell?
Okay, there is a hierarchy in the context of stem cells. How much we need to believe in it, I don't know. So as an embryo, when the embryo develops, the cells have the ability to form all the cell types of a body. The cells present in our body right now are not those embryonic cells, but a somewhat differentiated version of those cells. These are called adult or somatic stem cells. Somatic stem cells, to a large extent, a skin cell will differentiate into only a skin cell. It has the potency or the ability to only differentiate into a skin cell. A mammary cell will only differentiate into a mammary cell. So
So they come a little lower in the hierarchy of stem cells terminology. Take me with a pinch of salt and pepper, because some cells of certain organs have been shown to differentiate or called transdifferentiate. But there are experimental arguments in favor of it or not. To a large extent, in a tissue, we have cells that have only the ability to differentiate into that. So they are very low in the hierarchy of stem cells.
Sorry, last question.
It's a follow-up to what Gopal was asking. So,
there's a follow-up to a question which Gopal was also asking, and I'm wondering whether these are the, in a normally developing organism or tissue, let's say in memory tissue, is it the memory stem cell getting transformed into a cancer stem cell, or a cell which has committed to be a differentiated memory gland or cell, if those are getting back in the, like de-differentiating into a cancer stem cell? And the second part of the question is, if you have compared the cancer stem cells of the memory gland, whatever you have, with the expression profile of normal stem cell from different tissues, normal stem cells of different tissues, just to see if the memory cancer stem cells have lost the cell memory, their cell type specific expression program has been transformed into a different type of tissue.
To take your first question and to repeat it, is it possible that in humans when cancers arise, it's not the stem cell, but the next in order, which is the progenitor cell, that de-differentiates, becomes a stem cell and then does? Absolutely. I have nothing against that model. That's why I use the term stem slash progenitor. Because right now I don't even know who is a stem cell and who is a progenitor cell. So they can go back. If the initial mutations that arise in the progenitor converts it into a stem cell, then it will obviously be able to become a cancerous cell. So I have no arguments against it. The second one, have I compared the gene expression profiling of a mammary breast cancer stem cell with that of normal stem cells of multiple origins? I haven't done it, but I do believe there is a literature that has done it. And if you ask me, with 44,000 genes available, no matter what I compare with what, I will get a subset of gene signature that will either match and prove my hypothesis or not match and therefore not prove my hypothesis. Based on 44,000 genes and some signature pattern matching, I don't think it's possible to say make any conclusions. I don't believe it.
Well, before we break up, just a couple of announcements. First, a bit of bad news. People have to settle their